is Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. This year, on the 100th anniversary of that famous flight at Kitty Hawk, the one we always say that started the revolution in flying, we're going to take a look back at history and into the future of aviation. And in this hour, we're going to concentrate on the early ideas, experiments, and concepts that led to that 12-second flight in 1903, and the personalities of the pioneers of other inventors. And yes, there were other major contributors who sort of got lost in the history books and who were tinkering and inventing, some in gliders, some in balloons, all before the Wright brothers made their famous flight. Why did the Wright design succeed while others failed? What innovations did the Wright brothers come up with that made their flight possible? Why might the name Glenn Curtiss be familiar to you, but not Alberto Santos Dumont? And why did the Smithsonian refuse for 30 years to recognize that the Wright brothers were the first ones in flight? Well, we're going to talk about that, and if you'd like to join in our conversation, give us a call. Our number is 1-800-989-8255, 1-800-989-TALK. And as always, you can surf over to our website at Science Friday for more information. Let me introduce my guests. Paul Hoffman is the former editor-in-chief of Discover Magazine. He is a fellow of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. His latest book is Wings of Madness, Albert Santos Dumont and the Invention of Flight, published by Hyperion Books. He joins us by phone. Welcome back to Science Friday.
Thanks very much, Ira.
You're welcome. Also with us is Jack Carpenter. He is author of Pendulum 2, The Story of America's Three Aviation Pioneers, Wilbur Wright, Orville Wright, and Glenn Curtiss, The Henry Ford of Aviation, published by ABC Jack Carpenter Books. He joins us from the studios of KKJZ in Long Beach, California. Welcome to the program, Jack.
Thank you, Ira.
Also with us is Mike Lavelle. He is a historian and a consultant for the Museum of Flight. He is also an aviation maintenance manager at the Boeing Company, and he joins us from KUOW in Seattle. Thank you for being with us, Mr. Lavelle.
Thank you, Ira.
Welcome to the program. Would you all agree that that the Wright brothers, that famous flight in 1903, was, they were credited correctly with being the first ones to fly a powered airplane? Anybody disagree with that? I think we're all in agreement on that. Is that right?
Well, I will, Jack Carpenter, I will make one comment. You mentioned a 12-second flight. Actually, that was a jump. And the only... Actually, there were five trials, one on the 14th, four on the 17th, and the only one that was a true flight was the fifth one, which was by Wilbur Wright, which was 59 seconds and 852 feet. And when we tie in with Paul here, when he's talking about Alberto Santos Dumont, and Dumont did his flight, or his first, in effect, jump in Paris, the Wrights commented on that. Actually, Wilbur did to Octave Chanute in a letter in 1906, in which he defined the benchmark for flight as having to be over 300 feet. And he commented that the only one that he commented on in that letter was the 59-second flight. All others were jumps.
Of course, he was wrong in the sense that Santos Dumont actually went 700 feet, but it was after the Wrights. I mean, the thing is that many people had probably jumped in planes. I mean, it's easy to get into something and have it thrown into the air for 10 or 15 feet and come down crashing with no control. What the Wright brothers did was able to introduce control into an aircraft.
And
so the plane didn't roll.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Yeah, this is Mike Lavelle. I would add to that that control aspect is very important because after Kitty Hawk, the Wrights returned to Dayton and in the year 1904 continued their experiments on Hoffman Prairie. And by September of 1904, Wilbur, I believe it was, took off, completed a complete circle of the area, came back and landed from where he took off from. And that was a real demonstration of control. And by 1905, he was doing figure eights in the area and staying up aloft for longer periods than 30 minutes or so. So they continued with their experiments from Kitty Hawk. In essence, they had a practical airplane. the Wright Flyer 3 by 1905.
What was the impetus? It seems like there was a contest, so to speak, if that's the right word. And there are a lot of contests always in the history of technology. What was the impetus to develop an airplane just at that time, powered flight at that time? People were up in hot air balloons. They were in dirigibles. What was going on?
Well, may I point out here, Ira? The impetus at that particular time was the same one that brought us the automobile. It was the development of the internal combustion engine. And once we had a lightweight internal combustion engine, flight took off. Whether the Wrights or anyone else, it would have done it within a very short period of the culmination of the development of the internal combustion engine.
I mean, I write about in Wings of Madness how lots of well-heeled lawyers, oil tycoons, publishing barons in Europe had put up prizes for all sorts of aeronautical firsts, the first to fly across the English Channel, the first to fly around the Eiffel Tower 7-mile circular course in 30 minutes. And these rich men were driving aviation, certainly in Europe, and publishers wanted to get, you know, exclusive stories of either the success or the crashes, so they were putting up money for these firsts. So that was another impetus, certainly in Europe.
And in fact, the Wright brothers were careful to keep their flight secret.
Yes, that's the amazing thing, is that they chose the shores of North Carolina and Kitty Hawk as much for the favorable winds that would help push their plane into the air as for the secrecy. I mean, there was no press there to cover it. There were a few lifeguards who were, in the days before the Coast Guard, looking for shipwrecks, who saw this and would serve as witnesses afterwards. But they had gotten bad advice from patent attorneys that said that they might not be able to get a patent on their plane, and they were eager to sell it and profit from it. They didn't have much money. The man I write about in Wings of Madness, Alberto Sanis Dumont, inherited $600,000 from a coffee plantation that he grew up on in Brazil, and he could use that to finance his airship, so he didn't need to worry about the commercial possibilities.
And in fact, when he made his flight in Europe, he did not know about the Wright brothers, and he was sort of credited with being the first in flight for a period of time.
He was. I mean, even though he flew 3 years later in 1906, I mean, he was hailed by the New York Herald, by Scientific American. These are not newspapers that had or magazines that had a French bias, as the person who had conquered the air. The Wright brothers quickly went public. I mean, people had seen them fly in Ohio, but there hadn't been official accounts by aviation experts ringing up in the world's papers. And they came to Sanis Dumont's backyard, so to speak, France. And they had such a vastly superior plane and could go so further that people quickly accepted that they had flown first.
Mm-hmm. Of course,
what is also interesting... I'm sorry, this is Mike Lavelle. What is also interesting, even prior to the turn of the 20th century, another Frenchman by the name of Adour, he actually had a powered flight of 165 feet that was documented and witnessed by many. Again, it was one of these hops, but there was quite excitement at that time that was a real possibility to go further. In fact, he acquired a military contract from the Department of Defense for the French government to build a bigger aircraft, which turned out to be a failure.
So, Ira, Sanis Dumont's real claim to fame isn't the fact that people thought he flew first. It was that he flew the first working flying machine. And if you make a distinction between a plane and an airship, he invented the airship. I mean, he took a circular hot air balloon, switched it to a cigar shape, and strapped an internal combustion engine onto the bottom of it. And he flew it around the tip of the Eiffel Tower in 1901. There was a prize of $25,000 for doing this. And he was the first to do it. And he promised to give the money away to the poor of Paris. So you had a dozen kings and queens from Europe and all the peasants and beggars in Paris come out to watch this guy circle the top. Hmm. And H.G. Wells and Jules Verne were there. They were hanging out in an apartment that Eiffel, who built the tower, had designed for himself. They were hanging out in the apartment, seeing if Sanis Dumont would make it, because they wanted to see if the airships they had described so vividly in their science fiction would actually come to be in reality.
Mm-hmm.
And the airship.
Go ahead, Jack.
Well, along that line, and this is when maybe Curtis comes into the picture, because very rapidly after the development of Sanis Dumont's airship in France, Tom Baldwin and California, San Francisco, proceeded to do the same thing, and he was having problem finding good power for it. So that was when he and Curtis connected up, and actually Curtis then, that was Curtis's entree into aviation, helping Tom Baldwin with his airships. Incidentally, I might comment, Paul, when you mentioned Santos Dumont and his $600,000, in my writing, I always try and convert that, and that amount would have been approximately, well, in excess of $30 million today. So it gives you a better idea of how much money we're talking about.
There's an interesting side story. Another gentleman, I'll bring in another name of Samuel P. Langley. People know of places that are named after a guy named Langley, maybe not who he was. But the Smithsonian Institution, and he was a secretary of the Smithsonian, did not recognize Orville and Wilbur as being the first to fly. They recognized Langley. Why was that? Who would like to tell that story?
Well, he built what he called his aerodrome. These were these large planes that he launched from houseboats in the Potomac. I mean, they were very heavy contraptions. And they, too, came crashing down into the water. The pilot barely escaped. But the question was whether he had made a plane that was capable of flying or not, because there was controversy over whether it was the mechanism, a catapult mechanism that propelled it into the air, whether that was what was at fault or whether it was the engine of the plane itself. And this controversy went on for years, so that the Smithsonian claimed that, you know, their homeboy, so to speak, Langley, had been the first to fly. We should also mention that one of the reasons why people didn't believe that the Wright plane flights had taken place wasn't just because they were being secretive, but it was because Langley crashed, you know, I think about 10 days or a week before the Wright brothers flew, and they were ridiculed in the world's press because he had done a huge public demonstration of the flight. He had spent, I think, over $50,000, much less than the Wrights had, and people couldn't believe that two poorly educated bicycle mechanics from Dayton, Ohio, could succeed where the leading man of science in America, Langley, who headed the Smithsonian, had failed. I tell this story in Wings of Madness.
And you say that, and you talk about how it had to be. They then took the plane after the Wright brothers' successful flight, and they reflew it, but reconditioned it first.
Yes, Glenn Curtis reconditioned and was able to get it into the air, but he made some changes in it, so it's not clear that it could have flown then. And it's only in the last 20 years, believe it or not, that Smithsonian engineers, working with some engineers from NASA, actually reconstituted the plane exactly as it was when Langley flew it, and decided that it couldn't have flown at all. There were structural weaknesses in at least 8 places, and the plane would have just collapsed like it did when he flew it.
And it wasn't until the 1940s, I think, that the Smithsonian retracted and admitted that the Langley had not been the first in flight.
The Wrights were so piqued that they had actually given their flyer, the original plane, to a museum in London. So here it was, outside of the country. They were so annoyed.
Wow. I'll get back to you, Jack, and Mike.
Okay.
Hang on, because we have to take a break. And when we come back, we'll talk more about First in Flight with Paul Hoffman, Jack Carpenter, and Mike Lavelle, talking about their books. Excellent. Wings of Madness, Paul Hoffman's book, Wings of Madness, Albert Santos Dumont and the Invention of Flight. Jack Carpenter is the author of Pendulum 2, The Story of America's Three Aviation Pioneers, Wilbur Wright, Orville Wright, and Glenn Curtis. And the Henry Ford of Aviation, and Mike Lavelle, who's an historian and consultant for the Museum of Flight. Stay with us. We'll be right back after this short break and take lots more of your calls. Stay with us. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flato, and we're talking this hour about the history of flight, what was going on around the time of the turn of the century, with my guest, Paul Hoffman, author of The Wings of Madness, Albert Santos Dumont, and The Invention of Flight. He's also the author of The Man Who Loved Only Numbers. Jack Carpenter, author of Pendulum 2, the story of America's three aviation pioneers, Wilbur Wright, Orville Wright, and Glenn Curtis, the Henry Ford of aviation. And Mike Lavelle, who is a historian and a consultant for the Museum of Flight. Our number, 1-800-989-8255. Let me ask about some other pioneers you don't hear much about. Mike, who is Sir George Cayley?
Sir George Cayley was an English gentleman who lived in the Yorkshire area of northeast England. And he was a gentleman who came along at the right place and the right time. He grew up on an estate in England, so he had the resources in which to take his time to study natural history and then go on to more formal education in terms of the science and math. At the age of 19, he returned home to his estate, which is called Brompton Hall, and he had been interested in flight in terms of the helicopters that he's seen the demonstrations of, balloons, but he turned his attention to fixed-wing flight, and he looked at the birds, and the bird of choice that he was looking at was a hawk, and he noticed when the hawk wasn't flapping his wings, and that is, they were straight out and he was gliding, he theorized that the hawk was flying at an angle to the wind, and that was the reason it was able to glide and generate lift. And from that, he applied mathematical formulas, which helped to explain lift. And as a matter of fact, from that, he defined the problem of flight, which simply stated was he wanted to have a lifting surface to overcome the weight of a craft, and power to overcome the resistance of air. So he separated the lift and drag. He conducted formulas at Brompton Hall and basically came up with a configuration of the aircraft that we know today, and that was in the time period of 1804.
Hmm.
From that...
So he understood that you had to have some sort of angle of attack for the wing to push the air down and fly on it, like
That's
a bird
correct.
Would be doing?
He referred to that as the angle of incident, which we refer today as the angle of attack.
Incidentally, Paul, I want to compliment you on that description because, as we know today, George Cayley is known as the father of aerial navigation as a result of that work. So, incidentally, I'd like to go back briefly on this thing of talking about Langley. In 1896... Alexander Graham Bell, who was one of Langley's good friends, witnessed the model that of the aerodrome that Langley built, and it was the first successful flight of a heavier-than-air machine. But, and as you pointed it out, Paul, when Langley tried to upgrade that flying machine that he built in 1896, which was an unmanned machine, he did not take into account, the proper rules of construction, and so that when it was a full-size machine, it wasn't strong enough. Yes.
What was the competitive advantage that the Wright brothers had? What did they understand about powered flight that their competitors were a little behind on?
Well, again, what wasn't so difficult at that point was to put a lightweight internal combustion engine on a glider, okay? The problem was controlling it. And there are three sort of axes of rotation that you have in a plane. It can start, spinning in a horizontal plane. It could start, the nose could go down or the nose could go up, so it could spin in that plane, or it could roll. In other words, one wingtip going up and the other one going down. It's a roll that other people hadn't spent enough time on. And what they came up with is this solution called wing warping, where you could actually change the orientation of one side of the wing so that it would face the air at a different angle, and this would stop the plane from rolling. But if you look at Sanis Dumont's flight, the one that he was erroneously hailed by the world's press as flying the first plane when he did this, he only went 700 feet because he couldn't control roll at that point, and the plane essentially lost control of it and had to bring it down.
Hmm. Did the Wright brother design of the airplane, the Wright Flyer as we know it, did that lead to commercial aviation? Was that a flight? Why is not the Wright company the premier company that succeeded in creating airplanes? Paul finish first.
Yeah, I was going to say, it was a very slow process, actually. You think it just would have taken off. But these planes were much flimsier than people imagine. There were all sorts of things that could go wrong. And they did go wrong. People crashed in them all the time. And both the Wrights and Glenn Curtiss had exhibition companies to try to show that planes, you know, could actually fly and that were safe, because many people didn't want to go up in them. They had a suspicion of flying. We also have to remember there were cultural things against this, even though this was the end of the Industrial Revolution and sort of the peak of technological optimism. Flying had often been associated by religious authorities as interfering with the realm of the angels. I mean, it was witches that flew, and we didn't want to get too close to God. So there were a lot of theological objections to flight that had to be overcome.
Jack, did you want to say?
This is the first time I've heard the theological bit, but may I comment on this thing? Because, Ira, you talk about the Wright machine and wing warping, and, of course, when it was brought out, Octave Chanute did point out to the Wrights that he believed that there was a prior patent on that. But regardless of that, the Wright airplane was an extremely deadly and dangerous airplane to fly. It was prone to stall. It killed probably the majority of the pilots that tried to fly it. In 1914, the U.S. Army had its training facility at North Island, San Diego. 8 of 14 Wright-trained pilots were killed. From that point on, the Wright ceased being made. The last Wright was made in 1915. It was an inferior design. And that's fact.
Mike Lavelle?
Yeah, I'd like to kind of go back to not necessarily that point that Jack made, but why the Wrights were successful for the success that they did have. One of the things that they did, they took a strict engineering approach to the problem of flight, and their designs were consistent from their 1899 kite all the way up through their 1903 flyer. And they tackled the problem of control, as Paul mentioned earlier, from the outset. And that's what they thought was most important, and that's what they tried to solve. And once they came through and they felt they had that problem solved, that is control of the aircraft about all three axes that Paul mentioned, then they came back to Dayton and constructed their own power plant, their own propellers, and went back to Kitty Hawk in 03 and had that eventful day and went beyond that. So I think part of that success was their strict engineering approach. Paul mentioned that they had limited education. That's true as far as formal education. They did not complete their high school requirements. Orville elected to take advanced college courses instead, and Wilbur didn't attend his graduation. But they were well educated in the sense of understanding math, physics, science, and things of that nature, and that helped them a great deal to solve some of the problems of flight and calculating their lift formulas and constructing wind tunnels and things of that nature. So they were really the first true aeronautical engineers, despite some of the shortcomings of their first products.
Well, 800-989-8255 is our number. Let's go to Tom in Utica, New York. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Hi, go ahead.
Hi, my grandfather, Glenn C. Curtis, was a test pilot for, Glenn C. Harris was a test pilot for Glenn Curtis, and when I was a little kid, he pulled out a big black notebook and went into a discussion with diagrams of how inferior the Wright machine was and how questionable it was that what was publicly called the first flight was really actually a flight, touching on some of the things that have already been said about how it was a gust of wind, and it was a hop more than a flight, and he talked about the fact that it was ran on a track and a downhill slope. I wondered, you know, how public was any of this, you know, personal discourse or feud?
Did they voice these things in public? Did you hear them comment about each other? That's an interesting question.
Yeah, it was kind of a private little thing with my grandfather. He was, you know, very adamant about it, but, you know, I don't remember hearing anything publicly, you know, how this went personally.
Let me ask Mike Lavelle if he...
what I know about that, as everyone knows, the Wrights were very conservative and pretty much to themselves. They did correspond back and forth a time or two with Glenn Curtis concerning the patent infringements and things of that nature, but they didn't take it to the media as we know it today and have a discourse through the media that I'm aware of.
Well, the other thing that's interesting is the media was just full of misinformation about all the flights. I mean, again, since the Wright brothers weren't looking for publicity, the media had to grab what they could. And the Wrights were particularly galled by a story in their hometown newspaper in Dayton, where after they flew, the headline of the story was, "Wright Brothers Emulate Great Santos Dumont," because they had confused the fact that the Wrights had a plane, where Santos Dumont had a dirigible. They assumed that the Wrights had a dirigible. So if you go back and read the press reports, they get the lengths of the flights completely wrong. They drop a decimal or add a decimal. They get the times wrong. It's very difficult to know what's going on by looking at the popular press then. It's only afterward that historians were able to deconstruct a lot of what happened.
All right, Tom, Harold, thanks for calling.
Sure,
go ahead.
On this thing of what the public knew, basically the public knew very, very little because, first of all, everything that was done with the Wrights and the great amount of letter writing was done by Wilbur with Octave Chanute. All of those letters were kept from the public until 1953. Okay, everything, Wilbur died in 1912. Orville then wrote two or three variations of the story, and then he stopped writing. But I did a paper on that a while back called Dead Men Tell No Tales, or Do They? Because it wasn't until 1953 in the publication of the Wright papers that anybody could get a picture of actually what happened. And for 3-4 generations, the American public was never told or never knew the true story. And if you read the Wright papers and connect the dots, you come up with a story that's vastly different than what the public knows today. And that's all covered in my book. But I just might want to point that out. It's also on my website, GlennHCurtis.com.
How important was, you know, for invention, sometimes you have to have all the right ingredients that come together. And putting an engine on a glider, basically, would mean that you have to have the right kind of internal combustion engine invented, a lightweight engine. Was that one of the keys to being able to get this plane up in the air? Was the right engine finally available?
Absolutely.
It was indeed. It was indeed. And one of the problems with the Langley Aerodrome that he was trying to get in the air, he had the engine subcontracted out to a company in New York, Blauser, I believe the name of the company was. And it took them 3 years in the making to get it to him. The problem being it never did operate correctly. It was up to his assistant, Charles Manley, who really came on the scene and made a workable engine. And it was a good engine as well. He was able to produce about 52 horsepower and only weighed about 200 pounds when you put your fuels and oils and things in it. But it was Manley. The engine was an excellent engine. As mentioned before, I think Jack mentioned the structure of the aerodrome was one of the major downfalls. But the engine was important.
We're talking about the early days of flight this hour in Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. Yes, Jack.
Well, on this thing of the engine, I want to bring up the role and basically the largely unknown role of Alexander Graham Bell. Because it was about 1875 when he made the comment to Watson, his assistant, that someday we will be building machines that will be capable of flying the air like gulls at a far greater speed. Actually, it was Bell that saw the need for a lightweight engine, and he wanted to get into the air. And in 1907, he formed the Aero Experiment Association and brought Curtis into it because Curtis at that time was the maker of the finest lightweight internal combustion engines in the United States. He was making the finest motorcycles in the country at that time. And that's why Curtis was brought into aviation. Curtis had no concept of ever getting into heavier and air flight. But once he got in with Bell, he dropped motorcycles and then became the greatest name in aviation.
So he said he thought about this in 1875. That was the year before
1875.
The year before he filed his patent for the phone, for the telephone.
That's
even before the telephone, he was thinking about
the same time.
That's amazing.
Ira, when Alberto Santos Dumont flew his first powered airships in 1898, what he did was he commandeered an engine from his favorite vehicle, a motorized tricycle that he would go around Paris in. But he found it wasn't powerful enough, so he needed two of these engines. But then it wasn't just simply a matter of connecting them and, you know, strapping them to the balloon basket, he found that the engines didn't work very well when they weren't in the horizontal inclination that you would find an automobile in. I mean, there were problems with the fuel being distributed, there were problems with lubrication, so there were a lot of hurdles that had to be overcome before these engines could be used in aircraft.
And that's one of the things that's remarkable also about the Wright brothers. Obviously, they needed a power plant for their aircraft, and they built their own power plant with the assistance and help of their shop mechanic in the bicycle shop by the name of Charles Taylor. Their engine also weighed 200 pounds, much like Langley's, but it only put out 12 horsepower as opposed to the 50 horsepower Langley had. But Orville was quite happy with that because he calculated he only needed 6 horsepower to get in the air, so he actually had twice the horsepower that he needed.
How did he know what speed he needed? From glider flights?
Well, yes, from the calculations that they do in terms of what it requires to lift the machine, the weight the machine was, they calculated the weight of the Wright flyer with one of the brothers, and it would be about 750 pounds. And based on the lifting surface, he would need at least 6 horsepower to take it through the air with a airflow over the wing of roughly 30 miles an hour or so.
Because they had, I don't think people realize that they had experiments with the same, basically the same body without the engine on it as a glider.
That's correct.
Years beforehand, right? They were working.
That's right. And one of the things they wanted to do, and it's kind of uncharacteristic of the Wright brothers, because as I say, they use a methodical approach when they went out to Kitty Hawk. Their original intent was to use the 1903 glider first as a glider, as they had done their 1902, 1901 glider. But they also knew Langley was about ready to launch his airdrome. So there was a bit of an unspoken race, if you will. So they didn't test the glider without the engine. They simply put the engine, installed it, conducted some tests, did have some propeller shaft failures, and as Jack mentioned earlier, tried a flight on December the 14th, 1903, which ended pretty much right off the rail with Wilbur damaging the aircraft slightly.
Right, gentlemen, we have to take a short break. Stay with us. We'll come back and talk lots more about the early history of flight and take more of your questions. Don't go away. We'll be right back. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flato. A brief program note on Monday's Talk of the Nation. The UN finds itself at a crossroads. Join host Neil Conan for a discussion about the future of the United Nations. We're talking this hour about the early history of aviation with my guest, Paul Hoffman, author of Wings of Madness, Albert Santos Dumont and the Invention of Flight, Jack Carpenter, author of Pendulum 2, The Story of America's Three Aviation Pioneers, William Wright, Orville Wright, and Glenn Curtis, the Henry Ford of Aviation. And Mike Lavelle, a historian and consultant for the Museum of Flight. Also, he works out there at Boeing. Our number, 1-800-989-8255. Let's go to the phones. Let's go to Raleigh, North Carolina. Good place to go to on this anniversary, to Simone. Hi, Simone.
Hey, Ira. How are you?
How are you?
Doing pretty good, thank you.
Is Raleigh all a titter about this anniversary?
Oh, man, you talk about aviation here. This is the time to talk about aviation, I'm telling you. I have produced a documentary on Alberto Santos Dumont. I am a Brazilian living in North Carolina, and my documentary is called Heavier Than Air, and it has been receiving a lot of public attention here in North Carolina. The reason why I produced it was because I felt Santos Dumont needed a little bit more attention from, you know, he was not well known in outside of the aviation circles in America. I wanted the general public to know him more. I would like to congratulate Mr. Hoffman for his book. I anxiously waited for the book. It was a wonderful book. And what had just a quick question for him.
Sure.
Wanted to know why he thinks Santos Dumont is not well known by Americans as we would like him to be.
Well, you know, it's fascinating because in the year 1901, he was certainly the most famous person in Europe and maybe in the world, believe it or not. The London Times said 20 years from now, when the names of people who made great discoveries are forgotten, they will all be forgotten except for Alberto Santos Dumont. So the irony today is that outside of Brazil and some parts of France, people don't know too much about him.
Right.
But he was the inspiration, the spiritual inspiration, to many people that went into aviation in Europe. And when he flew around the tip of the Eiffel Tower, he flew before the largest crowd that had ever assembled in the world to date. And he gave away all the blueprints of his airships because he believed that planes would bring about world peace, that you'd be able to go and visit people with whom you had differences and iron out your differences. And of course, this is just 10 years or so before World War One, and after the First World War, he spends the rest of his life lobbying heads of states, kings and queens, all of them he could get an easy audience with because of his fame, to demilitarize space. Of course, he was unsuccessful, and he returns to Brazil, and in 1932, the first civil war in the world in which both sides are bombing each other. There have been plenty of military skirmishes with airplanes, but not a civil war where brothers were killing brothers, and a plane is shot down outside his hotel, and he can't stand that what he considered his babies, his inventions, had come to this, and he killed himself.
Wow.
Along that line, I might comment that, Ira, that in Pendulum also comment about Mr. Dumont, and you might notice on page 214, I say, today Brazilians revere him as the father of aviation.
And the thing is, he was also a father of fashion. He couldn't afford to take his hands off the controls of his airship to fish out his pocket watch, so he complained to his friend Louis Cartier that he needed to come up with some way that he could time his flights. So Cartier invented the wristwatch for him, their very first wristwatch, and that became a must-have accessory for fashion-conscious men in Europe.
No kidding. So that's how the wristwatch was invented.
Absolutely. It's still called, their first wristwatch is still called the Sanus Dumont.
Incidentally, one thing I'd like to bring out here, if I could, not too many Americans are aware of the fact that the Library of Congress seems to tell a little different story about aviation than the Smithsonian does. And in 1993, it brought out a very handsome calendar called Flight Before Wright and lists quite a few attempts at flight and flight that went on before the Wright brothers. And if you can get a hold of that calendar, I think you'd find it a very interesting thing and give you a perception of the Library of Congress.
Simone, thanks for calling. 1-800-989-8255. What other? Let me just bring back Mike Lavelle, who might tell us what other unsung heroes are there that we never hear about in the history of flight.
Well, you hear about Otto Lilienthal for his efforts and contributions he made in terms of flight with gliders. He was a trained engineer, lived in Germany. Very dedicated to the cause. He experimented with probably 16 different versions of a glider. He accumulated a lot of engineering data, lift data, that the Wrights used initially. And he had over 2,000 flights in terms of gliding. But that only accumulated in 5 hours of actual flying time. But he was probably the best well-known. In fact, he was internationally known. And unfortunately, he lost his life in a hang gliding accident in 1896. Prior to Otto Lilienthal, there had been some other attempts, some that had been recorded. One of the ones that is recorded goes back to Sir George Cayley, who in 1853, after spending 50 years in aeronautics, put together a machine. It looked like a, if you will, a rowboat with wheels, but it had a sail, and which you could have some control with pitch and yaw. And it's reported that he convinced his coachman he should become a test pilot, and they pulled him down the hill at Brompton Hall and actually got airborne. At the conclusion of the flight, the coachman said, "Sir George, I was hired to drive, not to fly." And there you had the first aviation crew member labor dispute.
How did we get from the Wright plane to actual planes that people would fly in, and decided that they were safe enough to fly in and be commercially viable?
That I'm going to bring up the fact of Glenn Curtis and his work with Alexander Graham Bell, because Actually, the most successful, well, the most, and I'm not an aeronautical engineer, and I think Michael will suspect that, but I think he'll also agree that the aileron is probably one of the most important parts of an airplane, and that patent, American patent on the aileron is held by Alexander Graham Bell and Curtis and Tom Selfridge and McCurdy and Baldwin. And it was Curtis that actually on July 4th, 1908, demonstrated, he made the first public flight in the United States. And his airplane, if you will think about it today, it had tricycle landing gear, it had a V8 engine, it had ailerons, it had a single propeller, and it had a control wheel. And that's almost the identical description of an airplane today. And so I'm going to say that it was probably Curtis more than anybody else that at least put the American aviation community into the air.
Mike Lavelle, you agree?
When you say put the American aviation community into the air, in terms of what we know of air travel, I think that was more of an evolution. I would agree with Jack that the aileron control system is a far superior system, obviously, than wing warping. But then you have events that accelerate technology. Some things that World War I, unfortunately, wars seem to have a way of accelerating technology. And then you roll into the 20s. And during the 20s, aviation design, as far as aircraft in America, I wouldn't say is stagnant, but you had bi-wing aircraft at the end of World War I, and you still had them going into the 30s. Now, in the 30s, despite the Depression, you had an explosion of technology going on simply because of better metals for aircraft construction, the engines. You had better aircraft systems. Fuel injection came on, pressurization. You had things of this nature, and so you have the event of a DC-3 showing up in 1935, and that's what really brought people to the airplane as far as day in and day out travel. So it was a combination of all kinds of improved systems.
We're talking about the history of early flight this hour on Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. Let's go to the phones again. Then we're going to go to Ohio, talking about the Wright brothers in Ohio. Let's go to Tom. Hi, Tom, in Hudson.
Hi. Two things I have read is that one reason the Wrights didn't improve their planes is that they spent too much time filing patent lawsuits and denigrating other people who had made flights in order to back up their patent suits. And that one of the people they denigrated was Gustav Whitehead, who was making flights with a monoplane with bicycle wheels years before the Wrights ever got off the ground.
Mike Lavelle?
Well, I've heard those stories as well, and I know there's different authors that have come forward with that particular description. But if you turn it over to the professional historians who have investigated that type of activity, which I'm not one, but Gustav Whitehead and his attempts, although may have some validity, they just couldn't be substantiated or documented to back up what he was saying. And that's not to say that that didn't occur.
What about all these patent fights we hear about? Jack Carpenter?
Well, the patent fight was one of the more interesting things, and again, it was the Wright patent, which was had a very broad interpretation by a court that knew very little about aerodynamics, and Curtis, and you have to understand, whenever you talk about Curtis, you have to, Bell was his partner, and Bell was kind of in the back room here, but Curtis and Bell fought the Wright brothers on that, and the interesting thing is, and it's brought out in the book, Henry Ford had just won his Selden patent fight, and because a fellow named Selden figured he had invented the automobile, and Ford said it was bunk. But Ford had to fight it, and Ford used an extremely fine attorney named Benton Crisp. And once he had won that fight, Ford was a friend of Curtis's. He actually visited Curtis in Hammondsport, and there's a picture of that. But they were friends because they were both motormen. But then Ford loaned Curtis Benton Crisp, and Benton Crisp then carried on that patent fight until finally, in the midst of World War I, the whole thing was, you know, everybody just said, let's call it quits.
Mm-hmm. Ira, the interesting thing is that Alberto Santos Dumont didn't have any fights because he didn't believe in patents. He gave everything away for free. his biggest contribution was making an airship so small that it can be considered the only aerial car that's ever been successful. He would land this
airship. Grasshopper.
Yeah, he would land this airship in front of his apartment on the Champs-Élysées, and every night he would fly to his favorite restaurant, Maxim's, where he would hand the reins of the airship to the doorman to hold while he went inside and dined. And he was given traffic tickets, not because he blocked the streets, but because pedestrians rushed into the streets to see this airship when he was overhead. And it's been a dream. It's been on the cover of popular science magazines for the last century, the idea of an aerial car. One guy did it. He flew everywhere in it. I mean, I worked for Michael Eisner at Disney. He could take a helicopter from his home to the Disney lot, but he couldn't fly to Spago for dinner or Barney's for shopping. This guy did it, and I write about it in Wings of Madness.
All right, we've run out of time, but we're going to continue our series on the history of flight and this 100th anniversary year. With more programming, we'll pick up where we left off here. I want to thank my guest, Paul Hoffman, author of Wings of Madness, Albert Santos Dumont, and the Invention of Flight, published by Thea Books. An excellent book if you want to read about this gentleman. It's just terrific, things you've never known before. Quite fascinating. Jack Carpenter is the author of Pendulum 2, The Story of America's Three Aviation Pioneers. Wilbur Wright, Orville Wright, and Glenn Curtis, The Henry Ford of Aviation. Also pretty good reading. I suggest that one also. Mike Lavelle is a historian and consultant for the Museum of Flight. He's also an aviation maintenance manager at the Boeing Company in Seattle. I want to thank you, gentlemen, all for taking time to talk with us today.
Thank you.
Thank
You're
you,
welcome.
Ara.
Thank you.
Our program is produced and directed by Annette Heist, Anna Lee Strachan, and senior producer Karen Vergoth. Charles Berquist is our web producer, and our interns are Anna Lee Strachan and Eric Holland. If you'd like to write, send your letters to Talk of the Nation Science Friday, 1221 6th Avenue, 37th floor, New York, New York, 10020. And if you surf over to our website at sciencefriday.com, we have curricula, free curricula, Science Friday's Kids Connection there that you can take and use in your classrooms. Also, you can listen to back editions of Science Friday on Real Audio or on your Audible .com players. And also, you can send us email there if you'd like. I'm Ira Flato in New York.